funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
This might come as a surprise given all the election season rhetoric about immigration, but the number of foreign-born people moving to the U.S. with or without legal permission to do so is slowing down. We continue to debate the effects of immigration on American culture and identity, but a look at the numbers shows that newcomers tend to be good for the U.S. economy. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Pia Arrhenius is senior economist at the Dallas Federal Reserve Bank and a fellow at SMU's John Tower Center. Her essay, "The Benefits of Immigration Outweigh the Costs," appears in the spring issue of The Catalyst, a journal of ideas from the Bush Institute, and can be read online at bushcenter.org. Pia, welcome back to Think.
Thanks for having me.
The first line of your essay says, "The contributions immigrants make remain an economic boost we cannot overlook." Is there a significant difference between the contributions of documented and undocumented immigrants? Does anyone have those numbers?
Well, there's a reason I didn't go into that in the article, because I think when you look at the economic contributions, it's actually difficult to make a distinction between. So we know that unauthorized immigrants, for example, tend to be more low-skilled. But when you compare them to other low-skilled immigrants, really there is no difference in terms of their economic contribution.
Why has immigration slowed since 2008?
Well, there's a little thing called the Great Recession, which was a tremendous economic downturn, which really slowed immigration, and especially slowed immigration from Mexico, which is our number one source country. And one reason it did that was because such a big part of the Great Recession was the housing bust and the slowdown in construction of single-family homes. And about a quarter to 30% of men who immigrate from Mexico, most of them unauthorized, work in the construction industry in single-family homes. And so when that market really collapsed, they stopped coming.
If there's been a net decrease in Mexican immigration in particular since the Great Recession, what do you think accounts for the current wave specifically of anti-Mexican sentiment among American voters?
That was partly this puzzle for me, partly motivated, you know, why I wrote the essay, because it really is striking that when we look, for example, whether it's legal immigration, which is also slowing down, but illegal immigration is very, you know, is totally off its highs. And it's really running at about, we looked at the apprehensions by the Border Patrol, they're running at levels that we've last seen in the early 1970s. So it's shocking how low the apprehensions are. And so by that, we infer the illegal immigrant population is also stagnant. That's what the demographers, I mean, it's hard to estimate, but they tend to estimate and find that it's either stagnant to declining slightly. There's about 12 million illegal immigrants in the U.S. And so, you know, given that this problem is sort of being addressed by the economy and also by border enforcement, frankly, and other enforcement measures that the government has been taking, and also improving conditions in Mexico. So all these factors together have slowed this immigration. So it really is very odd that it's gotten so much attention.
To the extent that immigration raises the GDP and the productive capacity of the United States, is that simply a factor of the attendant population growth, or is there more to it than that?
No, there is more to it than that, which is really makes it interesting to study from an economist's perspective, because it doesn't just make the economy larger. It makes it more productive. It makes it more efficient. There are a number of ways that immigrants do this. They tend to flow into occupations that are growing fast, where wages and opportunities are growing fast. And so this streamlining increases the efficiency with which the economy is running. They also tend to flow into regions that are growing very fast, which another, you know, if you think of native workers, we're more settled than immigrant workers because maybe they've come here more recently and they have fewer ties that bind. And so they move more readily to where there are opportunities. And that actually pays off in the aggregate economy. It means our economy, you're moving resources more quickly from a low-growing region to a high-growing region, which means on net, you're going to grow faster and you're going to have a more productive economy. There is one more point on the impact of immigration that's really important, which is high-skilled immigration in particular is very beneficial for productivity growth. And that's because the research has found that high-skilled immigrants, because so many of them are in the STEM fields, so science, technology, engineering, and math fields, they have a disproportionate impact on patenting and innovation, and that raises productivity growth. So that's actually really important.
I was really amazed to read that 44% of medical science workers and 42% of software designers are foreign-born immigrants. Does that say something about the kind of education we're providing to Americans born in this country?
I'm not sure if it says that. I mean, the United States economy is still the world's leading innovator, especially in the high tech and medical fields. And so I think it just means we've had such growth in demand in these areas. And, you know, we've been able to tap some of that growth, you know, with foreign-born workers. And so they've just been instrumental in, you know, the U.S. economy continuing to outperform in those industries.
You mentioned earlier that many immigrants are more willing than people born in this country to pick up and move to another part of the country where there may be more jobs. I wonder if that's a factor in, you know, places that have had pretty homogenous populations before, perceiving this influx of immigrants as somehow changing the dominant culture.
It is, I think. So I don't study that much of the political economy of immigration, but certainly where you see some of the more strident anti-immigrant legislation come to the fore, or feelings, or poll results. You see those in places, regions that are not used to having a lot of immigration. And in many cases, it's regions that are getting maybe also illegal immigration for the first time. And so there may be naturally resentment in that regard. We've seen the spread of these, we call them these anti-immigrant sort of omnibus bills in states like maybe in the Deep South and other regions where there's been a lot of sudden immigration to states that were not, that previously had very little immigration. And so you might look at a place like Alabama and you might say, well, why did they have such a strong reaction to immigration when they have so few immigrants? I mean, less than 2% of the population or something like that, last time I looked, was immigrant, or in particular undocumented immigrants. But it's just because it's something brand new for them.
So what's the situation for people who currently are U.S. citizens but are working in low-skill, low-wage jobs? Are they likely to be pushed out by a surge of immigrants coming in looking for jobs?
Yes, it's important when we look at the economics of immigration that we realize there are many benefits, but there are also costs. There's no, you know, economists like to say there's no free lunch. Sorry, that's a cliche. But it's true. There is no free lunch. And so on net, we gain from immigration. That's what the economics show. However, native workers that tend to perform similar jobs to immigrants are not going to benefit from the inflow of additional workers, especially not in what economists call the short to medium term. So there is a transition period, you know, after which, you know, the economy kind of can be restored to where it was originally. But before that happens, you do have adverse wage effects on competing native workers. So workers that are in low-skill jobs, whether it's, you know, landscaping, food service, construction, can be negatively impacted by immigration.
So what happens to wages? You know, the idea, I think many people are concerned that you bring in many workers who are working low-wage jobs, they will be more dependent on government services and, you know, help essentially to supplement the wages they're able to earn at these low-skill jobs.
Yes. So in the article I wrote, there wasn't really room to go into the fiscal, what we call the fiscal impact of immigration, but that's actually really important. So the one of the issues with how immigration policy in the U.S. has been run or not run, or the end result of the U.S. immigration policy, has been that we've had a lot of low-skilled immigration. And whereas there are economic benefits from low-skilled immigration and from high-skilled immigration, obviously, one of the issues with low-skilled immigrants, even though, you know, they're very economically active, have high labor force participation rates, very high employment rates and so forth, they tend to earn low wages, which means that they tend to pay less in taxes. This means that generally, once they settle here and have children and so forth, what they're contributing in taxes is not going to be sufficient to cover the costs, you know, that taxpayers are paying, you know, for things like education mostly for their children, but also sometimes healthcare costs.
Are we sort of economically at least better off, you know, welcoming immigrants who come as sort of single actors, people who are not tied to the obligations of a family and dependents?
Well, as an economist, so you would reason, you know, the reason the following way. Basically, what we've argued in the work that we've done on immigration policy in particular is that in terms of maximizing the economic benefits of immigration, what you should have the kind of policy that actually brings in more employment-based immigration, less family-based. The employment-based immigration streamlines more quickly into the labor market and also tends to be more high-skilled. And also, you obviously should be bringing people in legally and not letting them come illegally.
Mm-hmm. What are the impediments to allowing more people to immigrate legally who would fill open, in-demand, but low-skill, low-wage jobs? What would it take to let farm workers be in this country legally?
So farm workers, we have a pretty well-functioning and growing farm worker visa program, the H-2A program. Employers complained a long time that it was cumbersome, and it still is cumbersome to use and so forth. But usage has been increasing, I think, because so much of the unauthorized immigration has dropped off. So they are using that program. Now, that's not so hard to argue why we should let farm workers in, because they're overwhelmingly immigrants already. And so that's sort of a whole sector that's been, you know, converted to foreign-born workforce long time ago. I would say maybe during the Bracero program, that was a process that started. In other fields, it's difficult to argue. But what makes it most difficult to argue for implementing a well-functioning, well-run guest worker program for low-skilled workers is that if you look at wages of low-skilled workers, they've been stagnant, you know, especially for men since the late 1970s in real inflation-adjusted terms. So it's an uphill battle to argue that you need more workers in these industries when you look at wages and you see that they haven't really risen in real terms, you know, in 30 years.
There are people who say that once immigrants are here, they are contributing to the economy like everybody else, right? They're buying food and, you know, they have to have transportation and housing. What about the money that is lost to remittances that goes back to the countries of origin when workers come here by themselves?
Well, that's taking – sure. Immigrants come here in many cases to remit money home to help offset – you know, dire conditions in their home country. And I think as an economist, we tried to take more of a global view and say, this is exactly what you want to happen. You actually, an economic model would predict that if you have a country rich in labor, those laborers should move to a country that has more scarcity of labor. And if you have a country rich in capital, that the capital should flow to countries with a scarcity of capital. So this is exactly what you want, is in a sort of an economic theoretical sense, is you want the workers to go where there's work and you want the investment dollars to flow to where there's a need. And so the remittances are fulfilling that function as you would predict and as they should, because they raise living standards and lower poverty and increase investment in poor countries, especially the poorest regions of some of these poor countries. So they're helping the poorest of the poor. So I think, are they a negative effect on the local economy here in the United States? When people take money and they send it, is that a negative effect? Well, you might as well say, well, people shouldn't save any money then, because if you're saving money, you're not putting that into the economy. So I don't find that argument compelling at all. And also, if you look at how much remittances, you know, especially low-wage workers are sending home, it's such a small part for our aggregate economy. It's tiny, tiny share of consumption in our huge U.S. economy. But it's such a significant amount for those individual families. So I really, you know, this type of argument that remittances are bad because it's outflowing money flowing out, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
We're speaking this hour with Pia Arrhenius, who is senior economist at the Dallas Federal Reserve Bank and a fellow at SMU's John Tower Center. You can read her essay, The Benefits of Immigration Outweigh the Costs, in the spring issue of The Catalyst, a journal of ideas from the Bush Institute. You can find it for free online at bushcenter.org. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call in now to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Dallas Federal Reserve Bank senior economist Pia Arrhenius, a fellow at SMU's John Tower Center. You can read her essay, The Benefits of Immigration Outweigh the Costs, online at bushcenter.org. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Pia, how do rapidly rising immigrant populations in, you know, sections of the country where they haven't existed before affect things like housing availability and infrastructure and, you know, the cost of educating students?
Well, that's a good question. There is research showing that immigrants coming in do raise, obviously, the demand for housing, and so housing prices do go up. There was interesting work done looking at particularly at certain inner cities that were, dilapidated, dilapidated neighborhoods, so sort of looking back to the 1980s, early 1990s, where actually the immigrants came in and there was a revival in these areas and a lot of investment came in and those neighborhoods were improved. And so the rising housing price is not necessarily bad. It also, you know, means that demand for housing and probably the quality of housing is rising. So that's not necessarily bad. But certainly there is pressure on infrastructure and in particular public services like education when you have surges of immigration into certain regions. And the one issue is that students, foreign-born students or children in immigrant families often, if the parents particularly are in, you know, don't have a lot of education themselves, is that the students need additional services, which then, like language services, you know, learning English and so forth, or ESL, other types of bilingual programs. And these are expensive programs. And so they do impose additional costs and additional challenges for school districts.
Do 21st century immigrants assimilate into the broader culture at about the same rate as immigrants in the 20th century?
You know, there was just a report that came out by the National Academies of Sciences, which really, I think the conclusion was that there isn't much difference in terms of rates of assimilation if you look at people that came 100 years ago versus the people that are coming now. In particular, so when we worry about assimilation, we worry more about low-skilled immigrants because they don't come with the English fluency, for example, and maybe some of the college education that are required really to get the good jobs in this economy. The one challenge they pointed out, though, in today's environment is that the labor market is a lot more difficult to come into with fewer skills than it used to be. So if you came in 1900 and you got a job in a factory, it didn't matter that you weren't fluent in English. But if you come today, it'll be very unlikely that you'll work in a factory since so much of our manufacturing has, you know, been either replaced by technology or shipped overseas. And so there really aren't as many of those jobs where language, high-paying jobs or well-paying jobs, where language doesn't matter anymore. And so it is a tougher environment, so this wage growth and the ready assimilation we might have seen in a different type of labor market, we maybe are not seeing to as large an extent today. And I think if you look at income inequality, for example, has risen a lot, and I think that reflects some of the stagnation of the progress at the bottom.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Kaz in Bedford. Hi, Kaz.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm a former student of Dr. Arrhenius.
Hi, Kaz.
Hey. I'm going to try to be very succinct with my question because I'd really love to hear a really rich answer. Okay. For over 2 to 3 decades, we've been talking about a STEM employee shortage myth. But notable academics like UC Davis professor Norman Matloff and Salzman, Lowell, and Kuhn Company say that is a real myth. And if such a shortage exists, why isn't every BC grade graduate, native-born graduate of a public university, commanding $150,000 for starting salaries. The reason I ask this is because we're told that businesses honor the supply and demand law in pricing, but it seems they don't want to adhere to it when it comes to employees. And I'll just listen and really fascinated.
Thanks for your call.
Well, it's so he's a good student because he calls and asks hard questions. So on the STEM, the difficulty with the shortages in economics is that they have a very particular definition. And so how do we describe, you know, an industry where there's a lot of demand, you know, and relative to supply, if you will? In the STEM case, I think it is a particular case, especially when you think of the technology sector and the technology occupations, what's happened. And I think immigration has gotten caught up in this, but what's happened in technology fields is that there is probably a lot of age discrimination. So I think that a lot of the older workers in the tech fields get edged out by younger workers, and a lot of the younger workers are immigrants. And we have programs designed to bring in STEM workers, like the H-1B program brings in high-skilled, especially STEM workers. A lot of those workers that come on H-1Bs are computer programmers. A lot of them are from India. And so can you say, is there, we can't prove that there's a shortage necessarily. We know there's an extremely high demand for these H-1B workers. We know that we run out of H-1B visas every year, that there's not enough to cover private sector demand. So we know that corporations demand these workers. Now, whether, you know, but I think that the whole situation with tech workers in particular is confounded by this other problem that the new technology, the younger worker, you know, the corporations prefer the younger workers with the latest tech skills, and that's cheaper to hire them than to retrain older workers.
What are the prospects for low-skilled, undocumented workers who may have made a reasonable living during their working years when they have to retire based on age or, you know, physical decline? They may have been paying into Medicare and Social Security for years with a falsified Social Security card, but they don't qualify for the kinds of benefits that allow working-class people to at least survive through the retirement years.
So we haven't had a lot of experience with the particular demographic that you're mentioning, Chris, because still the undocumented workers tend to be fairly young and still working age, even if they came in the 80s or 90s. But certainly it's a problem that's on the horizon, and it's coming in the sense that, yes, they have paid into Social Security, but if they have not legalized their status, they will not access those funds. So Social Security has a fund called the Earnings Suspense File, which is all the earnings of all the workers that paid in under numbers that don't exist or don't match the name on the account. And I forget the number, but I think it's over $1 trillion in wages.
Wow.
Yes, of contributions of the. And if you look at the time pattern over the years, it looks very similar to the pattern of illegal immigration into the country. So we know it's mostly illegal immigrants contributing to the earnings suspense file, and they will not. They can access those earnings and the benefits that come with those earnings if they legalize and they kept sort of their W-2s, but otherwise they will not be able to access. And certainly that money is not in a lockbox. It's already been spent.
So it's not waiting for some change in policy. It will be spent for people who do have legal Social Security documents and Medicare documents.
Absolutely. And so the needs of these individuals obviously remain, and I think they fall on the social safety net, you know, whether it's Parkland Health System or whatever the corollary is in other cities across America. But the healthcare expenses are obviously a big problem looming for this particular population. In some cases, they may move back to Mexico if they are from Mexico. Mexico has actually implemented some social safety net programs that are working quite well, especially for some of the poor demographics. And so I could see that being a trend.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Nick on the line in Midlothian. Hi, Nick.
Hey, how's it going?
Very well, thanks.
As an IT worker in the medical field, when you go to places like Parkland, you see a large majority of, say, the emergency room patients are, for lack of a better word, and I'm not trying to seem mean or anything, as Hispanics. And a doctor friend and I were joking, he was joking the other day, just talking about a presidential candidate who said he was going to deport everyone. He said GM would never allow that because then the prices would fall on the Tahoes and, you know, Ford and Expeditions and everything. What is the actual cost medically to undocumented immigration. I was just kind of curious on that.
Are you talking about undocumented folks who need charity care at either public hospitals or private hospitals? Is that your question?
Correct.
What do you know about that, Pia?
I don't know so much about the dollar figures for the healthcare costs for undocumented immigrants. We know that obviously a lot of them are uninsured, but a lot of the low-skilled legal immigrants are uninsured. And in fact, in Texas, a lot of everyone is uninsured. We have the highest uninsured rate in the nation, in the state. So what the exact costs are, I don't know them. I know that the comptroller a few years ago of the state actually published a report, and there may be some numbers in there. But I know that the education costs are actually larger than the healthcare costs for this particular demographic, at least now, again, because they're still relatively young or they're at least working age. And they've been healthy. They are a particularly healthy demographic. And so they expect, I think there's a name for it in the research area. They call it the healthy Hispanic paradox or something like that. They're poorer, but they're healthier than sort of your average American. But I think definitely this is a challenge going forward.
This is shifting gears a little bit here, but can you talk a little bit about the trade relationship between the state of Texas and the country of Mexico and whether that would be irrevocably damaged by the construction of something like a wall that spanned the entire U.S. border? Would that be, in fact, perceived as worse by Mexico than the measures that we have in place now to keep people from crossing the border without proper permission?
I think the discussion of the wall is very misplaced. We have a very heavily enforced border. We have over 20,000 border patrol officers or agents patrolling that border day and night. We have technology. We have ground sensors. We have drones. We have cameras. We have a very heavily patrolled and enforced border that's actually achieving its objective. As I said earlier, it's astounding to look at the apprehension statistics. They are so low. And it's not because they're not catching the migrants. It's because the migrants are really deterred by the enforcement regime that's currently there, in addition to other factors, of course. But I think the enforcement regime has really worked. If you look at what people pay for smugglers, they used to, when I started studying this topic, early 1990s, people were paying $500-$600 to cross the border. Now they're paying $5,000 to cross the border. So the costs are sky high. And a lot of that is the enforcement and the penalties if you're caught. Everything has changed on the border. So the discussion of a wall is another one of these puzzles, which really would not be an investment that would make any sense. It would be very costly. And given how effective really the border enforcement already is, I think if you sit down and go through the numbers and you actually look at the stream of immigrants and how few are coming now illegally, I think that you would change your mind about this, you know, the logic of building a wall.
Do you think there would be an economic effect that would be good or bad for Texas based on the symbolism of the construction of something like a wall?
Well, the Mexicans, I think they're used to hearing lots of things from us in the U.S. And I think that they also have to some degree, there has to be some level of understanding on both sides of the border. I mean, maybe half of the Mexican immigrants in the U.S. are undocumented. And, you know, we're both parties to this situation, Mexicans as much as the Americans. We demanded this labor. These people came. They found gainful employment. They've been allowed to buy houses, to buy cars, get driver's licenses, that type of thing. This is the way things were for a long time. So we facilitated their entry, and the Mexicans did not deter or change the situation either. And so I think at the end of the day, if the rhetoric aside, I think everyone understands what the true situation is and really what the solutions are. I think when you have to be sensible about these things, there is a logical solution.
Well, you know, preparing for this interview, it occurred to me that almost everyone in America who is politically active to the extent that they vote can agree that immigration reform is something we need. What's different is that, the definition of what immigration reform looks like, the form that it takes, is very different based on political perspective. Do you have a sense as an economist of what a really pragmatic form of immigration reform could look like?
Oh, sure. So as an economist, again, I can, you know, I have my priorities. So if you look at economic growth, how would you do it? You would have, you would streamline the immigration policies. You would make sure that immigration was legal. You would bring in more high-skilled employment-based immigrants as opposed to, you know, more low-skilled or family-based immigrants. This mix would, you know, increase economic growth, and it would increase investment, and it would increase productivity. It would have a lot of nice side effects. And I think if you made the system simpler and more straightforward, you would also have less bureaucracy. Of course, my immigration lawyer friends, they joke with me that, you know, I'll put them out of business. But I tell them, well, you know, there always seems to be work for the lawyers.
Does it make sense to start with the people who are already here without documentation?
Yes. I'm glad you raised that, because there's talk of a temporary worker program or a guest worker program, maybe with Mexico, other countries. But I'm adamant, you know, when I write about immigration policy, that first you have to address the labor force that's already here, that's undocumented. And it wouldn't make sense to start bringing in new immigrants if you already have some pent up labor here in an undocumented status.
So how do you go about, I guess you would ask people to self-identify and then go through this process. It might be difficult to convince people that such a reform effort was not going to sort of leave them deported.
Well, again, just looking at the costs, you know, you're left really with very few options, because it would be very costly. Both obviously in terms of dollars and cents and in a humanitarian sense. But just look at the dollars, what it would cost to deport people, you know, 12 million or whatever the number would be, plus their family members. No, it's very costly, and it's humanitarian, you know, in a humanitarian sense, it's also unconscionable. But it's very costly, very expensive. The dollars, the investment would not make sense, because many of these currently unauthorized immigrants actually have some claim, they have applications pending for green cards, and they're just stuck in these long lines. And so they actually have, will probably be able to adjust status in the future. But because we restrict the number of green cards, it's actually been hard for them to get through the queue. Some of these family-based categories, we're processing people now today, giving them green cards, and they applied in the early 1990s.
We're speaking this hour with Pia Arrhenius, who is senior economist at the Dallas Federal Reserve Bank and a fellow at SMU's John Tower Center. You can read her essay, "The Benefits of Immigration Outweigh the Costs," in the spring issue of The Catalyst, a journal of ideas from the Bush Institute. It's online at bushcenter.org. We'll resume the conversation in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program, with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Pia Arrhenius, a fellow at SMU's Tower Center, who is senior economist at the Dallas Federal Reserve Bank. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Pia, as you well know, there are developed countries around the world that have declining birth rates. Their birth rates have fallen faster than those in the U.S., but the birth rates here are falling as well. There are places that are trying to recruit immigrants rather than keep them out in order to have a labor force that can care for aging populations and just fill the new kinds of jobs that are coming up in the economy. Is there a possibility that the United States will find itself in this position?
The United States demographically is doing pretty well. I mean, we're aging right now very quickly, faster than probably any other time in history. And so we have the baby boomers retiring. So we do have that issue, and we have significant aging going on. It is affecting the labor force and the growth of the labor force. And that is a concern in terms of economic growth. Our birth rates, however, are pretty robust. We still have a birth rate, I believe, of close to 2 per woman. And so that's close to replacement. And we've held up better with regard to the birth rate than many of these other countries, especially in Western Europe or Japan, for example. And Japan is a place where the population is actually shrinking. But certainly, countries are using immigration policy as a way to address some of the demographics. Canada is an example of that. They've been really wanting to grow their population, and they bring in tons, relative to their population, they bring in lots and lots of immigrants. They've been very aggressive with their immigration policy. And over 20% of the Canadian population is actually foreign-born. A place like Australia, 27% are foreign-born. And in the U.S., it's only 13% of our population is foreign-born. Now, that said, can you have an immigration policy that entirely offsets aging? No, it's not possible. It's too large. It's too it's where our population is too big. And really, you're not going to be able to have the type of immigration policy that will offset all the effects of aging or a declining birth rate. That said, it can certainly help. It doesn't hurt to have, an active immigration policy that at least tries to address some of the demographics and can offset some of the more severe impact.
So I don't know too much about the immigrant relatives of mine who arrived in this country from Germany and Ireland and Scotland, but I know they didn't come because they were doing great back in the old country. I wonder if you can understand the reasons why there are many Americans who have a sense that, you know, we're here and we are fully American, but we need to close the door behind, you know, our own relatives who are here.
Yes. I mean, to understand, if you look at the political economy literature that tries to look into this question of who wants to close the door and who wants to open the door wider, a lot of it has to do with high-skilled individuals, people with college education or more, tend to be more supportive of immigration than people with, you know, natives or Americans with less education. So that's an important difference. And so some people or observers, think tanks call the calls for more immigration or a more liberal immigration reform. They suggest that it's more of an elitist view in the sense that it's, reserved for people with more education and more wealth and so forth. And so that's one cut. But the other cut I've seen in terms of attitudes towards immigration is to do with age. So I see a lot of older people, older Americans worry about immigration. They see, they're not familiar with immigrants. They maybe haven't dealt so much with them. And so they really are more anti-immigrant than younger demographics. Younger people have dealt with immigrants and they've gone to school with them and they don't see them. And they don't see diversity as a threat either. And so I think there's a generational difference as well as an educational difference in the views on immigration.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Rod on the line in Arlington. Hi, Rod.
Hi. I was wondering what's the legal amount of Mexicans allowed into the country every year, you know?
That's a good question. So we have, in the immigration policy, we have unrestricted categories. Those are immediate relatives, of U.S. citizens. So that would be parents, children, and spouses. They come in without limit. Now, I don't remember exactly what the number is of Mexicans that come in under that program. So I'm not going to guess, but it's more than 100,000, I'll say. Every year, total green cards we give out is about 1.1 million, just to give you a reference. So there is one unrestricted category, but then the rest of all the categories, whether they're employment or family, are restricted. And they're restricted by category. They're also restricted by country. So there is a country quota, a limit on legal immigration from any one country. They cannot make up more than, I forget the exact cutoff, but a certain percentage, maybe it's 2% of all green cards can't go to more than one, can't go to one country.
What's the reason for a policy like that?
Oh, it's very odd, because what it means is that you have the same number of green card allotments in these restricted categories for a giant country like Mexico or China, which is obviously huge, or India. They get the same number of restricted green cards as a place like Luxembourg, which doesn't even have a million people. So it's really an outdated aspect of our immigration policy. But you have to think our immigration policy is over 50 years old. We're still working off of the 1965 Immigration and Nationality Act. And so much of it's completely outdated. And these numbers and these country quotas and the numbers that are in there are the same numbers, that were there 50 years ago. They have nothing to do with really the scope of the economy today, which is so much larger, and our population is so much larger. So it's really odd to be working with an immigration policy that's so dated and that really hasn't been changed substantially.
If they tapped you, Pia, as an economist to reset some of those quotas, I know this is a job that you'd want to give months and years of thought to, but should we look at, you know, the incoming demand, in other words, the number of people who want to come, and maybe set things that way? Would it make sense to simply go by global population and therefore leave the most spaces for India and China and sort of move down the line from there?
I'm not sure you restrict by country. I think you go on. We've argued. I wrote a book on this a few years ago with my co-author, Madeline Zavodny, and we wrote that you really should have a demand-based policy in terms of U.S. demand for workers, in particular foreign workers, and that should really drive immigration. So you don't want to give more spaces to Chinese just because Chinese want to come. I mean, you have to do immigration policy that's in the interest of Americans and people that live here. So you make it demand-based. So what do U.S. who do U.S. firms want to hire? And you don't really restrict that by country. That should really just be whoever really has the skills that, you know, U.S. industry needs to do better, to grow faster, to innovate. Those are the people that should be coming in.
Is there reason to believe that if we greatly, for lack of a better word, liberalized immigration policies for, let's just look at Latin America right now, that based on the pattern that we have established of people coming without documentation first and then sort of hoping to clear that up later, would that end that pattern of undocumented immigration if it were easier to come with legal documentation? Or would people still think it's still going to be faster to come in, you know, without permission and try to get a job and start my life?
Well, that's why when you do it, when we do immigration reform, that this should be really the first thing we address is how to get rid of or how to mitigate illegal immigration. There's always going to be some illegal immigration, but how do you mitigate it? The best way to mitigate it is you have some kind of guest worker program or a temporary worker program where people can come in legally, and it works well, and it works fast, and it's not so bureaucratic, and so that people, so it's a real alternative to undocumented or illegal immigration. That's really what you need, and that's going to be the one thing that's going to mitigate illegal immigration. And the other thing that you do at the same time is you obviously enforce the work site. So we've done a lot of research looking into electronic verification of employment authorization, this E-Verify program. And we've argued that when you do immigration reform, that you should actually implement mandatory universal E-Verify, where actually all employers should be checking to make sure their workers are allowed to work legally. I mean, it seems kind of like a no-brainer, but we don't really do it now. And so if you're serious about immigration reform, you want to do it right in a sustainable way that works. And again, to mitigate illegal immigration, this is how you do a functioning, a streamlined guest worker program together with worksite enforcement.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak now to Michael in Dallas. Hi, Michael.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Fantastic. I had a question about birthright, and I know in South Texas, hospitals there have an issue with an immigrant or a person coming across the border illegally, delivering a baby, and then the baby is a citizen, but I've never been able to find or read any federal law basis for that, that if you're born here, that you're automatically a citizen. My wife and I had an experience where we sailed into Australia and confronted immigration there. She was pregnant, and we were thinking, well, we'll have the baby here, and it'll be a dual citizen. But they have very clear immigration laws, and dad's American, mom's American, so we don't care if you have the baby here. The baby will be American, and the airport's over here. You need to leave or immigrate. So,
well, thank you for your call, Michael. What do you know about the rules for birthright citizenship, Pia?
I think that the interpretation, we have birthright citizenship based on an interpretation of, I think it's the 14th Amendment that says if you're born here and subject to the jurisdiction of the United States, then you are a U.S. citizen. And it is actually, as the caller suggested, Michael, he's right. I mean, it is fairly generous, actually. I think there are very few, I can't think of any at the moment, other countries that grant automatic citizenship just by virtue of being born here. So it's fairly generous policy. And you know, people have certainly argued both sides. They've argued that it's not a good policy, or they've argued that it's not the correct interpretation of the 14th Amendment. But I think that on the other side, you have to think that it's had a lot of benefits in the sense that we've had a lot fewer problems integrating and assimilating our immigrants than countries that haven't had this policy, so, and that have had a lot of immigration. So Germany is a classic example, you know, but there's many other examples. Japan, for example, where people can be, you know, second, third generation immigrants, and they're still not citizens. So that law has changed in Germany, but it used to be that way then. And so I don't think that anyone, given that people are going to stay, it's not a helpful policy if they can't, you know, become citizens. It really doesn't help, and it doesn't, you know, the only downside would be that if a lot of people are taking advantage of it by, as the caller suggested, you know, crossing the border or coming here from Asia, maybe like something that happens sometimes in California, people come and, I mean, but I think that the scale to which people are taking advantage of this is very small compared to some of the benefits.
We haven't talked much about children who are brought here when they're too young to make their own decisions and then sort of discover later in life, maybe when they go to apply for college, that they don't have citizenship. I'm sure that there are mediocre students among them, but boy, I've read a lot of stories of people who were really bright, seem to have the future open to them, and then realize they can't so much as qualify for federal student loans.
Yes, this is really a heartbreaking case. These are what they call the dreamers. So these are young people brought here by their parents, but their parents didn't come legally. And so they don't have legal status and they're not born here. So they're not citizens. And I think that the dreamers case for amnesty or for legal status actually is very compelling. And I think somehow it got caught up in politics, although I think that there was bipartisan support to get, you know, for the DREAM Act. In the end, what they have now is something called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, implemented by the Obama administration a few years ago. And so that's temporary status for them and a work permit and access to driver's licenses. So I think it's been helpful for them to continue their college education, but especially to work and work legally and get access to better jobs.
Can we solve the problems we have today with immigration, with undocumented immigration?
Can we solve them?
Yes.
Oh, absolutely. People just have to be a little forgiving. So like I said, it really is too expensive for an economist to argue for any kind of mass deportation. So you would take the more efficient solution would be, obviously, you know, people pay back taxes, some kind of penalty perhaps or fee, and get some type of legal status. It could be temporary, it could be provisional, it doesn't have to be a green card, it doesn't have to lead to citizenship. But I think there's a lot of arguments to be made for giving people legal permission to remain here, given that they're already here, they're already living here. A lot of times they have U.S.-born children, they own their home, they're already working. So there really is a lot of arguments to be made in favor of some type of policy to help them.
Pia Orenius is senior economist at the Dallas Federal Reserve Bank and a fellow at SMU's John Tower Center. Her essay, The Benefits of Immigration Outweigh the Costs, appears in the spring issue of The Catalyst, a journal of ideas from the Bush Institute. You can read it online at bushcenter.org. Pia, thank you so much for making time for us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Samantha Guzman is associate producer with help on the phones today from Alex Smith, and our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.